You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from UBC, located on the unceded traditional Coast Salish territory of the Musqueam people. Hello, and welcome to Intersections, presented by the Gender Empowerment Collective. This radio show is presented every 4 weeks, where we dig into topics about gender, race, and social justice. We open our show with a conversation between your hosts, followed by an interview with an expert on the topic that we will be discussing. Hello, and welcome to today's episode of Intersection. For this episode, please enjoy listening to the recording from the panel discussion that we held on March 31st entitled, "Am I Overreacting? Understanding and Combating Microaggressions." Thank you.
So we welcome you again to our event, "Am I Overreacting? Understanding and Combating Microaggressions." The purpose of tonight's panel discussion is to recognize and discuss possible ways to address microaggressions in the workplace, on campus, in academia, and among other spaces. We want to gain an understanding of what microaggressions are and how they affect people belonging to equity-seeking communities based on race, class, gender, sex, religion, and other identities. We will be drawing on examples of covert racism and looking at how it impacts marginalized people in their personal and professional lives. We will be looking for tangible solutions for both those who experience microaggressions and those who witness slash perpetuate them. And finally, we hope to touch upon the historical context of microaggressions and why they continue to be prevalent. And I'll get on to introducing the speakers. So firstly, we welcome Dr. Nandini Maharaj, who is a Vancouver-based writer covering mental health, career, identity, and relationships. Her essays and opinion pieces have appeared in HuffPost Canada, Animal Wellness, Introvert, Dear, and Medium, including the article, "Why People Go Out of Their Way to Mispronounce My Foreign-Sounding Name." And secondly, we also welcome Dr. Alifa Bandali, and she is a lecturer in the Institute for Gender, Race, Sexuality, and Social Justice. Her research focuses on feminist activism, both in institutional and creative spaces. And I will now pass it on to Anastasia, who will be leading us through the moderated discussion.
Hi, my name is Anastasia, and I'm another member of the Gender Empowerment Collective, and I'm very excited to be conducting the interview segment, which will be the main part of our event and will be around 25 minutes. And we'll be asking I'll be asking our panelists questions to start the conversation, and you should feel free to put your questions in Slido as they're answering my questions. So welcome, Dr. Bandali and Dr. Maharaj, and I'll just be referring to you as Alifa and Nandini. But yeah, how are you guys?
Hi, I'm doing well. Thank you for having me. If you're hearing some strange noises when I'm talking, I have two dogs flanking me. So if you hear bizarre noises, that's what it is.
Yeah, thank you for having me as well. I think I mentioned even before we began today that this is just a really wonderful opportunity to have the space to even talk about what microaggressions even are. I think even as I was thinking about today's event, I wasn't even sure what they were. And after reading more about them, I was like, yes. So thank you for creating such a space.
Yeah, we've been really wanting to do this event for a while. And yeah, I actually, you're asking like, what are they? And that's exactly what I'm going to ask both of you is how would you explain the term microaggression in two sentences-ish? And a short definition of those for those who might be new to the idea of microaggressions. And why don't we start off with Alifa, since you said you did some research, I guess.
But Yeah, I it's so funny because I just go off of my own experiences here, so I can't speak to a particular kind of definition because I think it looks so different for so many of us, depending on the intersections of our own identities, life histories, and experiences. But as I was, doing a Google kind of search, I had an idea of what I understood of microaggressions. And I think what seems to come through when I've been looking through more of it or better understanding it, often it's what we can't describe. It can be this feeling that doesn't sit right with us. And that is based on something that maybe that isn't overt or so hostile or so in our face or so blunt, but that is palpable and that we feel. And so sometimes it's hard to describe that feeling. And I think that is where I would want to situate what a microaggression is. And it could be so varied depending on context. I know that sounds like probably not the best way to give a kind of definition, but I think it's this feeling that doesn't sit right with us, and it's somehow or can be so hard to explain. That's why I really appreciate everyone, being able to be a part of this conversation, because there's so many ways in which for the numerous perspectives to better understand what it is.
The intangible nature and the sort of sense that you're experiencing something and that level of uncertainty around it. It could be a comment or a gesture that comes across as a put down or an insult, and you sort of feel in that moment and even after you leave the interaction that you've been offended or slighted in some way. These microaggressions, they're, I think, meant to communicate biases against people from marginalized communities. And it can be based on your religion, disability, sexual orientation, gender. And frequent targets of microaggressions are women, racialized people, and members of the LGBTQ+ community. And so the level of distress tends to be pronounced because you don't know the person's intent. So sometimes people say, well, it's unintentional. So there's a lot of ambiguity in the situation.
Yeah, like that's exactly why I was just like, itching to have this conversation, because it is intangible and it's coded. And our second question was, what are some examples of covert racism and how does it impact marginalized people in their personal and professional lives? And if you'd like, if you feel comfortable, any personal experiences you've had, but only if you feel comfortable. And I guess we'll start with Nandini. Nandini.
Sure. So as I was noting, that it can be something behavioral, words or gestures. And in terms of comments that someone might make to a racialized person would be, a question like, where are you from originally? Telling someone, with some degree of surprise, you speak English fluently or perfectly. And so you're sort of signaling to them that they're, perhaps a foreigner in this land, and you're sometimes it's sort of cloaked as a compliment, but it doesn't feel that way to the person. So I would say it's also includes an element of othering. So you're saying you're different from the rest of us. And in terms of more kind of subtle gestures, a very common example, seeing a Black or brown person, particularly a man, and clutching your bag a little tighter, tensing up, having that kind of reaction. Something that I've experienced non-verbally in a professional setting is having a colleague look down when I'm speaking and refusing to make eye contact with me, sitting, like leaving a seat between us when we're at a meeting. So those were things that are distressing. And as I think you notice the behavior, but it's hard to make sense of what's happening to you.
Yeah, thank you for sharing those, Nandini. I would agree. I was writing them down because I think similarly, you know, these gestures or even folks walking through that, folks walking away faster or you know, holding on to something if they do see a racialized person, usually a man of color and usually a Black man, as we've seen actually in different in the media or in popular culture more broadly as well, or in everyday life. And I think based on my own experiences of where this has kind of come through is, you know, even in sitting in meetings, and this is in an academic sense as well, when we talk about hiring practices, and it's, I've had colleagues who have done this and not knowing what their words mean or how they matter. And they said, when we talked about someone being hired and especially having someone who's representative of Black, Indigenous or a person of color, and they said, well, unfortunately, you know, it didn't work out. And they didn't even talk about race as specific as thinking about race, but they said, you know, racial dimensions. Well, what do you mean by something like racial dimensions, right? Just, you know, and it's that kind of elusive language sometimes that you just are thinking, what's happening here, especially when they're people of color who are sitting in that room, whose identity then you just kind of negated in that sense with this sort of euphemism of something like a racial dimension, without any kind of regard of who's there or what you're saying. And I think it goes so unnoticed sometimes that for me anyways, in my own experiences, it's something that I have to reflect on after the moment because I don't understand it sometimes in the moment. And then I have to come back to, and it's happened in several sort of ways, again, in academia too. And this isn't a previous institution, but the fact that, you know, this kind of not only happens in meetings, but then when you talk to many of your colleagues or people around you who think you are the other South Asian woman who you work with in your department. And because both of your names start with A's, that you are the same person because you're both South Asian, you know? And so I think it's, we see it in that way and it goes so unnoticed. And for me anyways, based on my own experiences, it's not till after those moments because I can't understand what's just happened because it's happening. And to reflect on it later is where I just think, wow, you know, I don't know how else to say it.
Red Camp Records is an amazing artist-owned and operated record store. Shop from their diverse online music collection and get free shipping within Vancouver and the Lower Mainland with the purchase of two or more LPs. If you would like to further support them through the evolving COVID-19 crisis, you can do so by buying a gift card to use at a later date. Visit www.redcat.ca for more information. It's
Feeling lost in the lonely, meaningless cyber web? Looking to connect with other users? Then plug in to a CITR collective. Meet users who are compatible with your interests and passions. CITR's mainframe offers 9 unique collectives: news, arts, accessibility, sports, persons of color, indigenous, gender empowerment, LGBTQ2SIA+, and music affairs. CITR collectives are where you can make great radio, great friends, and avoid the abject loneliness of life in the cyber void.
Loneliness.
Wow. Thank you both for sharing your experiences. I feel like that's so like useful maybe too, because like a lot of us here, not all of us, are in college and you guys are in more professional spaces. And like, yeah, like it definitely doesn't stop. Most people aren't aware of how to act. But our next question is, do microaggressions lead to larger acts of violence? And like, do you believe microaggressions lead to larger acts of violence? And if yes, how so? We'll start with you, Alifa, if you don't mind.
No, I think that's a really useful and important question. I think, too, it depends on what kind of violence we're speaking of. Symbolic violence, absolutely. We see that, especially in just when I was drawing on my own experience of a previous working environment where I was, confused with one of my colleagues because we're both South Asian. We both have this, you know, a first name that starts with an A. And to then work with that person who is in my department and to see them every day, knowing that that's what they think or, you know, how they move in the world is, for me, violent in a way that, again, as we've talked about microaggressions being something that we can't always name or pinpoint, have that repeated or see that person who is embodying this kind of violence, I think, even if it's perhaps not physical violence, it's still a part of symbolic violence. And I do believe too, physical violence can arise from microaggressions. I think especially, for example, in heightened conditions and circumstances, as we're thinking about, you know, living in a pandemic where there's so much happening in everyone's lives, whether that's, you know, losing employment or different kinds of conditions or this ways in which, you know, financially, materially, we are, you know, being impacted in different ways that, of course, I think, we can see how this gets, especially that, Nandini, as you mentioned, that othering and this kind of fear of the other that can then, I think, and does lead to physical violence.
I agree with you, Alifa, and I think that we're seeing that playing out with what we collectively, for lack of a better word, with anti-Asian violence, that the language that was used to describe the pandemic, we see that that has led to physical violence against women, against elderly people, and that's something that's so in our daily lives where we think that these jokes, these insults, these ways of targeting people, they really don't matter, but they do. And something like right now the trial for George Floyd's death, that we're also seeing that reaction that you have to a Black man, that you see him in a space that you criminalize him in terms of, like, I've experienced someone following me around a store, so that you're assuming some kind of criminal intent, that it does have an impact on the way that people perceive you, how you interact with those in authority. I think just even for me, as a personal example, with an undergrad at UBC, being accused of cheating on an exam and accessing a professor's office without permission. I had a professor come in who was sort of, I guess, doing, you know, policing his colleague's office and, confiscated my exam. And it was a very uncomfortable encounter. And I think things like that, they sort of, I still remember that was many years ago. And I still feel like a tightness in my chest when I talk about it. And so I think in terms of the harms, there's this cumulative stress that people experience, and it can be in terms of depression, anxiety. So I don't think, you know, that I think when you mentioned larger acts of violence, I think that, yes, as Alifa mentioned, when you feel like your resources are being threatened, that the way to deal with that sometimes is to target the group that you feel like is taking something away from you. And that's why it's so harmful. They're not just, you know, subtle, harmless cons. As I'm talking about it, I'm still feeling that kind of trauma from that exchange. So it does have a long-term impact.
Thank you for sharing. And this is like a safe space for you to share that. Yeah, I'm really glad you mentioned the anti-Asian violence, just because we obviously thought of that, even though we had thought about this for 6 months. But it's, you know, it's very tragic that, you know, and also that it's been so accepted, these microaggressions. And also the accumulative stress is something that I feel like, yeah, should be talked about more as an experience that marginalized people have. And our next question is, how can BIPOC folks respond to microaggressions in their everyday lives and in their workplace? What are some suggestions that you think they might be able to respond to it? Like maybe personally or, you know, to the person. Alifa,
I mean, that's the question, right? Like part of why I wanted to be an academic was, Nandini, very similar to an undergraduate experience, a different experience, but one that I still remember and that, you know, drives me to not want this to happen to another student, for example, is one of my professors, I think in my second year, I was disputing a mark, right? You know, I was like, oh, this is a low mark. I have to go and find out what happened here. And as he was talking to me, he was like, oh, you know, like here are some issues. And, you know, if, you know, English isn't your first language. So, you know, I understand. And I just so puzzled by this. And I felt embarrassed, even though he should have felt embarrassed for even thinking or saying that. And it was the shame on me that I was not, you know, grammatically so correct for someone who, you know, supposed to have English as their first language, which is, you know, it's pretty much the only language I thought that I had somehow kind of mastered. And I actually said to him, I go, what do you mean? At that time, I was like, no, I, you know, I'm was born in like just outside of Vancouver. And then he was like, oh, no, that's not what I meant. You know, it was kind of like, well, one, how dare you even correct me or even ask? And two, it was more like, well, how do I fix this? And in him remarking my paper, I shall just kind of finish this anecdote, gave me the same mark. So that kind of feeling I'm still left with even today in sharing the story is one of the reasons why I wanted to, you know, become an academic or, you know, you know, a teacher of some kind, even as a lecturer at the university level, because I didn't have people who, one, look like me, and two, who could understand the experiences of someone who wasn't white, because so many of my professors in undergraduate were white. And, you know, they couldn't understand sometimes where folks were or racialized folks were coming from, especially BIPOC students. And I think that is a part of something I'm very deeply passionate about, because I can't understand exactly what everyone is experiencing based on the intersections of their identities, but I know that feeling. And in different ways, I think that has, you know, undergraduate students continue to face and feel even today. And so in some suggestions or responding to, and this is a tough one because I think it also depends on the circumstances, the context, you know, is there a power relationship or something happening here too? And my thing is always to question. It's always to be like, well, what do you mean by that? And then it really has that person having to rethink, what did I just say? And what did it mean? Or how did it come across? Because sometimes too, it can be a disconnect, right? It can be that they didn't mean to say something. And so I would rather give someone the benefit of the doubt of that maybe it came across incorrectly and not that they were being ignorant or you know, having something that they didn't intend, right? And perhaps I'm more optimistic in humanity that way, but yeah, that would be one approach at least. Nandini, I'd love to hear maybe some of your probably more useful approaches and strategies.
I wouldn't say they're more useful. I really relate to what you said about the power dynamic, and just even with my name, that's where I really feel the effect of when you are in a relationship with someone that they have some kind of authority over you, not being able to correct them when they mispronounce my name. So that's something that I experience in my current role and in past experiences, or even when was in a client counseling. I used to work as a counselor. And so sometimes with a client, you don't feel like you can, correct them after you've been working with them for weeks or something like that. So those kinds of exchanges are, fraught with how do you navigate a relationship with someone that's going to be ongoing versus a one-off situation. So something I think in terms of like your psychological and physical safety, is it safe to confront them about what you've just heard, to even ask them, I heard you say this, is that what you meant? Or can you help me understand what you were trying to get across? I would also consider if it's in terms of an ongoing relationship, it could be a family member, a friend, it could be a professional relationship, a supervisor or professor at school. And I think as a racialized person myself, there's sort of this calculus that I go through. Is it worth it to say something? Am I going to walk away after and think, oh, I wish I'd said something? And so when you feel like you have to let it go in that moment, you do feel that toll, that it's emotionally taxing to have to kind of just absorb all of those feelings and just kind of swallow them down. And so you also wonder if you're telling that person that you condone what they've done or what they've said, and perhaps that they might do this to someone else. I've also had situations where I felt comfortable or, felt like I really needed to speak up and say something. And at the time when it happened in the moment, I've been told that I was being unprofessional. I've had friends who've been in a similar situation and they're labeled as being aggressive. Like you become the aggressor in the situation by correcting someone. If you let it go for a week and try to de-escalate the situation, then, there's this risk that you'll be thought of as like, you can't let something go. You're petty, or they've already moved on and you're just, holding on to anger that it didn't even faze them at all. And so I think it's that, as I mentioned, that we use the word calculus, is it worth it? So something that I go through all the time. And I think in my current role as a staff member, I generally let them go now because the power dynamic is such that I don't feel like I can say anything.
Thank you for both of your perspectives on the matter. It's kind of depressing, but I hope that this is me being an optimist, but I hope with people talking more about it, that maybe like white people like myself will at least realize that they should know, but I mean, who knows? Now I would like to ask you guys if, what are some steps that allies to marginalized communities can take to combat microaggressions? And let's start with you, Nandini, if you don't mind.
I think in terms of being an ally, I think doing some reflecting on your biases. I always hear unconscious bias, and I've never liked that term. I think it's unexamined biases. Maybe you're unwilling to engage with them, which that could be that you're not interacting with a diverse group of people. So that's something you can do, just sort of expand your horizons. It doesn't necessarily have to mean, meeting people. You can read and educate yourself about how you can be a supportive ally. I think the most powerful thing for me personally, when I do as I said, I think I left on a depressing note in my last comment in terms of letting things go. Something that I do for self-care is I do share what I've experienced with someone that I trust. And if it's somebody who is a non-racialized person, I think the most powerful thing they can do for me in that moment is to believe me. I think people try to get into this mode of problem solving and wanting things to be better. And so they are very quick to suggest that person didn't mean what they said. You know, they want me to feel better. So it's well-intentioned, but it doesn't make me feel better. I actually had an experience in a recent time with someone who asked me, you know, I heard this exchange and I felt like what this person was doing was sexist, but not, I don't see how race was involved. Like, why is race involved here? And I said, I didn't actually say this to them because I just didn't feel like it was, they just weren't understanding where I was coming from. And I just thought, you know, the idea of your intersectional identity, I can't take off my being a woman hat and my being a person of color hat. So I think having to, you know, justify your experience to someone is really, it can kind of re-traumatize you from the original situation. So I would say, you know, one, believe someone, be open to having someone correct you if you've made the microaggression yourself in the past, or if you're, just giving them space to share what's going on and to not try to fix it, because it's probably not fixable, unfortunately.
Yeah, just to, Nandini, just to build off your ideas, because I agree, and I think that is so important, especially as we consider to better understand actually what allyship is and what it looks like in different ways, because again, it's one of those things that is encompasses so much, again, based on the intersections of our own identities, our life histories and experiences. And with respectful engagement, I like how you said this learning process, because that's what it is. It's about learning. We're, you know, even for myself, I'm always going to be a work in progress, right? And I think a part of that is what I would ask allies, or, you know, even just to suggest, just in part of that learning is to learn about the systemic and institutional forms of oppression that take shape. And if we think about the Canadian context as well, know, for example, the specificities of, you know, anti-Black racism in Canada, or colonial violence towards Indigenous communities as well, right? And for racialized communities more broadly, but to understand these histories. And even if you don't know all of these histories, that's not what I'm saying here. It's to open yourself up to understanding that, so that we don't perpetuate some of these traumas or violences, right? In whatever forms they take shape and take place. And this takes time, it takes work, right? This learning process is not an easy fix, Nandini, as you were noting, right? It's not gonna take shape in one kind of conversation. This is definitely a starting point, right? To get multiple conversations and dialogues happening, which is so important. But I think also a part of this too with allies is, it's not only opening up your mind to be open to learning about histories, right, or forms of oppression, or even frameworks such as intersectionality, but it's about opening your heart. And I mean, genuinely opening up your heart, so that it's not, I was just talking to one of my classes about this, so I think it's like fresh in my mind about allyship, but, you know, it's being genuine and honest. So even if, you know, we make mistakes, that's okay. You know, those will happen. And that's part of where that learning also happens. But I think a part of too, sometimes with allyship, some sentiments kind of happen where if you are, you know, if there is a correction to a mistake, or, you know, opening up, trying to open up someone's mind, and they get defensive. And I think this is sometimes what we see. And it's, you know, how do we then help folks? And it's, is it even our role to help folks to not be defensive, right? And that's part of the issue here too, right? Is we can't always control what that looks like, even if we are trying to open folks' hearts and minds up, right? And often too, we see what it means to be defensive, or how this comes through. And I think, Nandini, especially coming to your point of having folks believe, right? To believe folks. But when this is met with being defensive, that is a really difficult kind of thing to navigate and negotiate through. I don't think I have an answer there, but maybe just something to kind of open up here.
Thank you both. We've actually reached the end of this segment, this interview segment. It's been like, I feel quite emotional personally, so I don't know, and we're now going to have the audience Q&A, and so audience, feel free to continue to submit your questions to the Slido link, and now we're going to move on to Chimgi, who will be taking questions from the Slido and asking our panelists. Thanks again, guys.
Without the help and support of our friends, we here at CITR wouldn't be able to bring you all the great music, art, cinema, and culture that you love. Thanks to the long-standing support from the Rio Theater, we are able to keep you informed on all the great artists, films, and everything else coming to town there. For all the current information about who and what's playing at the Rio Theater, visit their website at www.riotheater.ca.
Join us every other Wednesday from 6:30 to 8 p.m. for Sam Squanch's Hideaway with your host, Anita B., as she plays all Canadian music with a focus on indie rock and pop.
Thank you, Anastasia, and thank you, Alifa and Anthony, for sharing your insights and experiences so far. They definitely resonate with me, and I can imagine they do for so many people here. So anyway, I'm Chimgi. I'm another member of the collective. And as Anastasia said, I will be posing the questions from the audience to both of you. So thank you all for your participation so far. Our first question is, our highly voted one is, how do you confront people you are close to when they perpetuate a microaggression against you? Nandini, if you want to start.
I think we both kind of touched on this, but in terms of, and I don't mean to say that in a way of dismissing the question, I think it's an important question, but I think being willing to take that risk in that relationship, to let someone know the I think it's the difference between intention and impact. Where someone who, if their first reaction is to try to explain or justify what they've said or done, that might sound like, oh, I never meant to say that, or that's not what I said. Or sometimes I've actually heard sort of a right out denial of, I never said anything like that. And so I think in terms of trying to share with the person, the more of the impact of what they said and why it was harmful to you. And I think also just letting them know that, you know, we have this relationship and I value our relationship and I feel like I trust you enough to be able to say this to you. And I also want you to, you know, hear this from me, and this is coming from a place of I want our relationship to continue to grow and to feel like I can share these feelings with you, and I hope that you receive this in this manner, or something, you know, something like that. And I think being able to say that that you're hurt, you know, my reaction, I think in terms of what Alifa said as well, you know, it's about building empathy. I want to help you understand why this is harmful and why I feel like I need to bring this up, and as uncomfortable as it is. And I think for me, my reaction is if I, you know, do something harmful, I feel bad. And so I think just kind of going back to that idea of, like, we want to have relationships where we, you know, we see ourselves as being good people. And so hearing that it might be jarring for the person, but to hear anything different. But I think it's important to try to open up that conversation to say, especially if it's somebody that you're going to have an ongoing relationship with, to take that risk and try that.
Yeah, Nandini, that was kind of what I was thinking too, but I really like that idea of impact and intention and, you know, what it means to value relationships. And it's often too, when I do try to confront or have conversations, it's because I actually value that person that I want to have this kind of a conversation. When I don't, you know, care necessarily about some of these conversations or interactions, I'll just stop them, right? But it's where, you know, I care that I want to actually put in the time and effort and to talk this through, or it won't always necessarily be finished in one kind of a dialogue or conversation, but it's that ongoing work. And that's where I place value, right? I want to grow with someone. I want to understand what's happening and we can build relationships moving forward. And if I may just draw on an experience, it's always tough. I always found it tough talking to my dad about racism, because as a South Asian man, he moved from Africa to Canada. And at that point, you know, when they moved here, they didn't have much. They were just trying to make it. So they kept their head down. They worked. They didn't try and do anything to shake anything up, right? And then, you know, the next generation, some of us try to shake things up because we just saw what our parents went through and what we were going through. And we're like, that's it. Can't do it. But it's hard to explain that sometimes. Or I had trouble explaining that to my dad. So one time we were talking about racism and we were just driving in the car and it came up, and it was so, you know, it's because I valued my relationship. So I wanted to have this conversation, and he wasn't understanding that how racism exists and how institutionalized it is. So then I just had to tell him. I have three siblings, and the older two are very fair skinned, and the younger two, including myself, with myself included, are darker skin, right? And so I asked my dad, I go, now which out of your kids have been profiled by the police? And he's like, oh, well, you know, I know my brother, who's also darker like me, he has. And I go, I have too. You know, this happened to me, and I explained the story to him, and he goes, I didn't know that. And it was in that moment he could kind of understand how race was operating here, how we can think about authority figures and what was happening, so that the next kinds of conversations we could have, for example, about racism and how institutionalized it is and how this kind of comes through, he could see it from his own kids in a way. And as much as it kind of hurt me to talk about it, because it is hurtful when that happens, it led to, you know, more questions and more conversation that, you know, he could hear me instead of just dismissing me, because he knew from me someone it happened to and someone he loves and cares about that that's not right. And I think we can't always have those moments, but when we're able to, they can mean something. Yeah, maybe I'll leave it there.
Yeah, thank you for sharing. I think that's so true. They are traumatic racial experiences, right? So it is emotional labor to go and discuss them, but yeah, some relationships are worth it to build upon that and share those feelings as well. So our next question is, how does one navigate to determining if they are over or underreacting? And I mean, that's kind of the name of our panel today. So I think it's good that we touch upon this one. Alifa, if you want to start.
Sure. I mean, with the over underreacting, I cannot imagine what that means. What is this perfect reaction we're supposed to have? I don't know it. I definitely certainly don't always have it either. And what I'm supposed to do, because in those feelings of what we're supposed to do, they're often based in dominant ideologies or norms that are acceptable. So I don't really understand what the right kind of reaction is, or just a reaction, right? Because based on, again, the intersections of your identity, and especially for racialized folks, you may be, you know, there's tropes and stereotypes that then get prescribed onto you, is that especially for brown and black bodies, right? You know, if you overreacting, then you're angry, and then you always get kind of depicted as this person in future kind of meetings with these people, for example, with colleagues, right? So I, even in academic spaces, in previous academic spaces, you know, I try to be funny, I try to be nice, I try to, you know, be as welcoming as possible. And I think I like to be like that normally, but I often catch myself or police myself in certain circumstances and situations, right? So then that way I can have the sort of right kind of reaction. But more recently, the more I come to understand that that's actually more harmful, even for myself, to have to try and be so collected all the time. You know, whatever reaction you're feeling, whatever emotions you're feeling, you have to feel them. Of course, I know this is context specific and there's power relations at play in many circumstances and situations, but a friend of mine said, you have to feel your feelings. And I think it's so important because they are coming from somewhere. And as we have been speaking about microaggressions, you know, something we can't always pinpoint or name or always define, part of that not defining, you know, is based in our emotions that are so necessary.
I completely agree and I think that in terms of emotions, they're such a powerful signal of what's happening to us. Sometimes as we've talked about, it's hard to sort of pinpoint what the behavior is sometimes, but when I do share this experiences that I've had, when I reflect on it, I am able to say this person said this and this is why it was upsetting. And there's always a behavior that sort of that I'm observing, and sometimes it feels like a gut feeling. And I think that when people hear that, they it starts to feel like it's imaginary, it's so intangible. And I really try to push back against that and say that there's always something. I have a trail of what's happened that's led me to have this feeling. And I think another thing that I would offer is, you know, sometimes there are these kinds of innocuous statements that people make around, you know, I'm colorblind, I don't see color. We often hear of late, you know, all lives matter. There's only one race, the human race. And I would say to that, you know, that racialized people, we want you to see our color. We want you to acknowledge that our experience is different, even if you can't imagine what that's like. To just simply say that, you know, everyone, if like to assume that, you know, university is a meritocracy, try hard enough that you'll succeed. And then if things aren't going well and you're not living up to what you want to do, that somehow your failure has to do with you as a person and not because of opportunities. And so I would say, you know, in terms of this context, to validate for people that their experience is different and that is their lived experience.
Yeah, I think it's important to, yeah, there is no right like reaction, because whatever we're feeling, I guess, is the right reaction, as you said, Alifa, and it's important that we do validate these feelings because yeah, we don't need to be gaslighting ourselves. Like, I feel like the rest of society is like there to do that for us. So internally, we should be validating ourselves and how we feel. So we've discussed like allyship before in the previous segment. And now we have this question of how can we hold these allies accountable to call out microaggressions in the workplace or outside? Nandini, if you want to start.
I think in terms, sorry, you were saying, how do we call out allies?
Definitely. I did go through that a little bit quickly. So how can we hold allies accountable, especially those who have made commitments to be anti-racist or against different forms of discrimination as well. So how can we hold them accountable to be calling out microaggressions in the workplace or outside, or kind of providing that allyship? How can we hold them accountable to do that, to honor their commitment?
Thank you for repeating that. I think in terms of, as I said before, with there's just such power in believing someone and validating their experience. It sounds like such a small thing, but I've had so many experiences in my life where people are just very quick to minimize and explain away what's happening to me. And you mentioned the term gaslighting as well, just that idea of people trying to change the reality that you're experiencing and downplay what it is. And I also feel like this is, it's not meant to be, if you're willing to share with someone that something is upsetting, is offensive, is you're having, that this is what you've experienced, if you're willing to share that with them, and they are, you know, defensive and they have that conversation, I think, you know, using our communication skills to say, you know, like, I want to have this conversation with you. I don't think we're hearing each other. Is there something, is there another time that we can talk about this? I want you to understand where I'm coming from. And I think in terms of allies, another piece in addition to believing people is also that your role is to try to understand the person's experience, but not to rely on them to educate you about what they're experiencing. I think that for you to go away and do that work, there's, as I said, there's a ton of literature out there. There are, brilliant personal essays that I've read, as much as you can as possible to sort of recognize these examples and experiences. I think you're going to be better placed to have these discussions. And so I think that's really key. The idea, like, your job is to understand their experience, but not treat them as your teacher to educate you about this.
Yeah, Nandini, I really liked how you brought that aspect of education here, because I think for most folks, access to Google, and like you mentioned, you know, with personal essays, there's so much, you know, so many websites like the anti-oppression website that talks about allyship, respectful engagement. There's so many folks working on and writing about this, and that, you know, for most who are able to access resources, right? What it means to hold an ally accountable is a massive kind of undertaking. So what I would say is, you know, as best we can, to kind of share what we're willing to share with folks in terms of our own experiences, and trying to do some of this educating work without having to overdo it, I think, depending on our own capacities as well. But folks, like, for those who are seeking to be allies, they have to really open up their hearts and minds, because if that's not open, then no matter what you say to hold others accountable, it may not work. And I always worry too, especially I think for so many of you who are so, you know, interested in social justice work, or thinking about opening up so many of these spaces and conversations, is you all have to take care of yourselves as well. You know, these aren't easy conversations you all are seeking to be a part of and open up. And often they have and can and will be met with hostility and defensiveness. And so you really too have to look after yourselves, so that, you know, holding allies accountable may not always be what you're able to do, and to know and to be okay, you know, to be okay with that, because it's not always, Nandini, coming back to your point about educating others as well. Because for folks to truly want to be allies, it has to come from a genuine sort of heart-mind connection that has to come through for themselves.
Yeah, thank you. That's true. It has to be there for them, like a genuine intent on doing so. Anyway, thank you for answering. That's the end of this audience Q&A. So thank you for answering all of our questions. I mean, not all of our questions, but we got through a good chunk of them. And thank you to the audience for your engagement. And I'm sorry that if we didn't get to your question, but I hope that you still, received some value and validation from all these, from this conversation. So now I'll pass it off to Tahia to handle the closing remarks.
Yeah, so thank you everyone for submitting all of your questions, and thank you to our wonderful panelists for taking the time to answer all of our questions. Before I kind of give closing remarks from all of us here at CITR, I wanted to turn the floor over to both of our panelists and ask if you guys had any sort of parting words of advice for us. I'll go to you first, Dr. Bandali.
I just wanted to thank you for this opportunity. It's been great to share and connect with you all. I think the reason why, as I mentioned, I didn't really understand, I was kind of looking up microaggression. I had this idea of what it was. I think because when I was an undergrad, nothing was ever talked about. You just kind of swept it under the rug and pretended like it didn't happen. Like I shared, it was that my embarrassment there. And by calling it or thinking about what microaggressions are and what they're doing is so important, because by naming it and by calling attention to it, which you all are, and opening up these conversations, more folks are able to then, as we have noted, something we can't always note or pinpoint, the more folks talk about it and make it visible, the more we can start making these connections, even in our own everyday lives, and building a community and safe spaces. So I think, in fact, some of the best sort of ways, and you all are a credit to this, is that you are opening up these spaces where people feel comfortable to even consider what this is, and to realize that it's not about what was mentioned too, the so we don't have to self-gaslight, or so we don't have to think about controlling our reactions or emotions because they're not what we expect others to think of ourselves. And of course, there's so many, again, power dynamics, and this is all contextual as well. But by opening up these conversations and providing spaces for it, you are allowing folks to consider something that perhaps they have been, maybe pushing deep down, so they don't have to, whether that's for those who experience microaggressions or even for those who have, unknowingly been a part of them as doing it to others, right? So thank you.
And I also want to just say thank you to Alifa for sharing your experiences. And I really liked what you said about naming and opening up conversations. Just even the essay that was mentioned that I've written, I've had people who are connecting with me and wanting to, correct people on misgendering and mispronunciations of their names. In closing, one thing I wanted to offer, and I don't think I touched on this, was not just in terms of addressing microaggressions, but in terms of preventing them in the first place, I would also just emphasize that if you're feeling some kind of desire to comment on someone's, making a comment about somebody based on their identity, that's where I would, especially if you're not part of the group that they belong to, I would, maybe take a pause and think about, what's your purpose here? Is it meant to harm the person in any way? Or are you trying to be funny or gossip or make light of their experience? And to use that as your guide to maybe avoid those kinds of traps where you're entering into something that's actually going to be harmful. I think just learning more about people's identities and coming from a place of curiosity rather than making assumptions about them. And we don't always have to voice every thought that comes into our head. So I just wanted to make that point as well. So thank you so much, all of you, for having me into the audience as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
sorry, I just wanted to say thank you, Nandini, as well. I meant to say that I appreciate all of your thoughts, and again, to everyone as well. Sorry, I'll stop, but
thank you. Yeah, thank you guys for that wonderful advice. And so I just want to say, on behalf of all of us here at CITR. Thank you guys for taking the time out of your day to come and speak at our event. We know you guys are both very busy. And then to all of our wonderful audience members, thank you guys for asking all of your questions. We hope that it was somewhat of a stimulating conversation around microaggressions. This is a topic that tends to be a controversial point of discussion. And so it can be kind of hard to come together in a group like this where everyone's open and willing to talk about it. So thank you guys for just making it a safe space.
Thank you for listening to Intersections, presented by the Gender Empowerment Collective. Tune in again in 4 weeks to catch our next episode. We can always be reached at our email, genderempowerment@citr.ca, for comments, feedback, and topic ideas. Music by Hero.